It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. If you want people to eat healthy, why make it so expensive? Well, this was the question asked of reporter Tracy McMillan. It came from a frustrated teenager in a poor New York neighborhood. Until then, for Tracy, food wasn't relevant to her job as a serious journalist. After that question, she launched on an undercover journey. She joined the working poor in harvest fields, supermarkets, and a restaurant. She lived, ate, and worked, as we do, when short money has to trump long-term health. Well, stay with us for the story and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today we're checking out some L.A. neighborhood eats you might not know unless you're a local. A reporter lives the great American dichotomy. Who can afford to eat the way they say we're supposed to? Moroccan vegetables are on the agenda, and a favorite writer returns. Jay McInerney is a novelist. Critics say he writes generation-defining books like Bright Lights, Big City, and How It Ended. But this novelist has also been labeled the best wine writer in America. Well, for him, it's a natural combo. I think Jay loves the role of student when it comes to wine. You can read his columns in the Wall Street Journal and in his latest book, The Juice, Vinus Veritas. Jay, good to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Lynn. Nice to be back.
Hey, how did you get into drinking wine?
Well, I think that literature actually inspired my interest in wine. I think probably it started with Hemingway, who wrote so much about people drinking wine, particularly in his first novel, The Sun Also Rises. You know, everybody was constantly drinking wine. And shortly after that, I think I read Bride's Head Revisited, where there's quite a bit of serious wine drinking. And that was pretty much the start of my interest in wine. I also I think it was a point in wine's favor that my parents didn't drink it. And, of course, anything that my parents didn't do was potentially cool and sophisticated. But I suppose my obsession with wine began when I was writing my first novel. And in order to make ends meet, I was working as a clerk in a wine store. And I would take the occasional bottle home at night. Well, honestly, every night. And also the owner had a wonderful library of wine books, even though most of our business was fortified grape juice, things like MD 2020 and Wild Irish Rose. But that was the beginning of training my palate.
There's something I want to get into with you. I want to talk about white wines. There's one in my mind. The wine we ignore, Chablis. Why do people not drink Chablis?
Well, one reason is because many of us grew up drinking something very inferior to Le Vrai Chablis, the real Chablis. And that's to say that many wine regions around the world created something called Chablis in order to capitalize on the popularity of the French Chablis, the wine made in this particular area of northwest Burgundy. So there's an awful lot of ersatz Chablis, and basically it could be almost anything, but it was seldom good. So an awful lot of people have never actually encountered the real thing. Curiously enough, it's made from the most popular grape in the world, which is the Chardonnay grape, although it tastes like anything but the typical California Chardonnay. It's much leaner, and it often has, many of us think, a kind of a mineral element. It seems to some people that you can taste this sort of underlying limestone soil, which is made up of millions of years of oyster shells compressed together. It's a rock formation called the Kimmeridgian, which stretches from the White Cliffs of Dover to Chablis. And this is still a controversial idea, but one that the French take absolutely for granted, that the characteristics of a wine are largely a function of the underlying minerals and soil. So it seems at the very least appropriate that it goes so well with oysters and any kind of light seafood.
Yeah. So what would be a great value in Chablis? What would be the low-end price that I could still drink really nice Chablis?
Well, you know, the good thing about global warming, a phenomenon that no wine grower in the world will deny, is that there are many more ripe vintages in Chablis than it used to be. That there were only three good vintages in a decade.
Wow.
Now, for better or for worse, the last four have been very good, 2007, 2008, 2009, and 2010, although they have different styles. And in any of these years, you can get a good wine that is just labeled Chablis, which is the sort of the generic or village wine. I would not recommend going down to the lowest level, which is the Petit Chablis, but I would say that you can safely get a really good bottle of Chablis for $25.
Well, that's not super cheap, but also you're talking really, really, really good.
Well, and that's, but keep in mind these are small, you know, these are artisanal wines, hand-picked. They're handcrafted virtually, and this is not necessarily something that you're going to drink every single day. But I think it is well worth spending $25 on a good bottle.
You know, Pinot Grigio is a wine that is being drunk constantly now, but there was a time when nobody ever went near it. I mean, it's almost replacing Chardonnay as being so popular.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's become a sort of a generic term almost for white wine. It wasn't until, I believe it was 1979, that a guy named Tony Terlato was visiting Italy. He was a wine importer, and he tasted a wine he really liked, and he went and sought this wine at the source, which happens to be a place called Alto Adige in the north of Italy. And he discovered a winery called Santa Margherita, and he liked the wine so much that he got the exclusive rights to import it to the States, and he grew the brand because it became very popular. It is now the largest-selling imported white wine in the United States.
Wow.
I think they import 600,000 cases or something along those lines. And it remains very popular, although it's lost some of its cachet with the wine cognoscenti, but partly because of overproduction and overpopularity, I guess.
Well, it's really delicious. I mean, it can be really delicious, but
– it can be.
What
– And also, what we're talking about price. You can get a good bottle of Pinot Grigio for $15 to $20.
Can you name some names for us?
One of my current favorites is made in California called Palmina. From Italy, I like Alois Lagaderer and Tunina.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have I live out in Long Island in the summer, and there's some good ones starting to pop up there. The Channing Daughters makes a wonderful
made on Long Island.
Made on Long Island, yes. And of all places in Slovenia, they make what I think is the greatest Pinot Grigio of all, a producer called Movia. And if you taste this wine, you will be truly inspired by the potential for Pinot Grigio. But in general, it's a wine that shouldn't be taken too seriously, and it's a perfect summer quaff.
Well, I like the idea of Slovenia, and I love the idea of Long Island. Two sources that you don't immediately think of.
I scout the world so that you can drink better.
You sure do. Jay, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Jay McInerney is author of The Juice. Now, to go with a summer white, try our recipe for smoky salmon steaks. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. And it is still salmon season. And there's one other recipe you should make before it's over in September. No heat is needed. A little salmon goes a very long way, and there's practically no work. The dish is gravlax. This is salmon cured in the fridge with salt and sugar and spices and dill. You serve it in paper-thin slices, so a pound easily feeds 6 to 8, and maybe even more. And that cure teases out all the deliciousness of summer salmon. So get some wild Alaskan salmon and check out the website for salmon gravlax with fresh dill. That's splendidtable.org. And Angela Kim is always checking out the L.A. food scene. She blogs about her finds on her blog, Angela Is Here. Well, she's on the line from L.A. Angela, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be back.
So what's this area, West L.A.? What is this like?
West L.A. is basically west of the 405 freeway, and there's a little strip over there. I call it Sawtelle, but other people used to call it Little Osaka. So this is a lot different from the Little Tokyo that we know in downtown L.A., which is about 10 miles east.
Uh-huh.
And Little Osaka, a.k.a. Sawtelle, is actually just a stretch, literally just a few blocks, where it used to be mostly nursery gardening stores with a heavy Japanese-American influence, like where they would sell bonsai trees, orchids, and also a bunch of small businesses owned by Japanese-Americans. So you'll see a lot of older noodle shops around there, some sushi places. But in the last year, there has been this energy of younger people hanging out there. First, I thought it was just the food trucks because they would just kind of congregate in the evening. But I noticed last summer that a lot of newer businesses were opening up by younger people. And it just infused a lot of great energy. And a lot of new people were beginning to find this little tucked away neighborhood.
So what are you finding there?
Oh, there's this amazing noodle place called Sujita LA Artisan Noodle. And the original is actually in Tokyo. And even though noodle is in the title, they don't serve the noodles except for lunch. So they have very specific rules. In the evening, they have very izakaya, small plates, fusion type food.
Right.
But what I love, it's all about the noodles for lunch. And what I go there for is the asukemen ramen, which is basically a little bit thicker than your brothy noodles.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't come in one bowl. You get two bowls, one with just the bare noodles that are chilled, and then another bowl with the sauce. And don't mix them. That's what I wanted to do.
Oh, you don't pour the sauce over the noodles?
No. You keep it separate. Because the sauce is like a gravy, very thick, concentrated, heavy pork flavor. And so it's also a bit salty. So you get your chopsticks, get a little bit of the noodles, and elegantly dip it in the second bowl, and then you eat it.
Oh.
And I know, because for me, when I get hungry, I just want to eat. I want to inhale it. But doing this, it made me actually think of the flavors, realize what I'm eating. And also, it kind of made me understand the complex flavors. And I want another bite and another because of that nice saltiness.
Just fabulous. So what else is in the neighborhood?
Oh, next door, there's a coffee shop that opened. But the thing that I like there isn't the coffee. If the coffee is good, trust me, it's good.
Right.
But it's the pretzels. And this isn't your, butter-drenched mall pretzel. This is gourmet pretzels made to order. And I ordered the sweet potato puree and mozzarella pretzel.
Wait a minute. Oh. This is in the pretzel?
It's in the pretzel. It's amazing. Oh, when they first serve it out, you still see the steam kind of coming up from the pretzel. And when you smell it, you smell that sweet, sweet smell from the potato. And the thing is, when you take a bite, too, you get that nice crunch, that snap when you bite into a pretzel.
Right.
And the great thing is you taste that sweetness from the potato first. Then you get the saltiness from the mozzarella cheese. And your brain's like, what's going on? And you have to grab another bite and another.
What's the name of the place?
It's called Coffee Tomo.
One more.
Okay, next door, if you want dessert, there's a place called Blockhead's Shavery. And they do a shave ice, nothing like the Hawaiian shave ice, where it's super fine, fine grains of ice that they kind of form into a big snowball. This place, they shave the ice too, but the ice isn't clear ice. They actually infuse it with milk. And so it's creamy, but they shave it. And when they shave it, it's like really, really fine sheets of ice. So it's just like curled up thin, thin, thin sheets of milky ice. And sometimes they put flavors in the ice as well. They could put strawberry, chocolate, black sesame. I got the original, which is like a milky cream.
Uh-huh.
And then you choose a topping. It could be any fruit or chocolate that they have. I chose strawberries because I love strawberries. And they also have purees. And I also got the strawberry puree because I can never get enough. And you can get a little topping on the side to other toppings as well. I got the homemade mochi. Oh, my God.
It's That's like, the sweet pounded rice. It's almost like a dough, and then it can be crumbled, right?
Yeah, and the thing is, it's like little bits of clouds. It's soft, it's chewy, it's pillowy, like imagine little pillows. And it works really well with the texture of the really fine ice, the creaminess that comes from the ice. And they put so much thought into it. They gave it to me in a little cup on the side because they said if you have it on top of the ice, it would get really hard and I would kind of miss the whole experience of it. It's amazing. And the line, literally, like, it is out the door and around the corner some nights.
Okay, we've got to hit West LA. Hey, Angela, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Angela Kim blogs about her LA food finds at Angela Is Here. Now, for where she eats in West LA, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, we're going to be back with the American way of eating that is not the foodie's dream. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, sometimes all the food sloganese we live with is totally overwhelming. To be healthy, you have to eat five a day. Eat local, eat organic, and live better. Vote with your fork. And of course, good, healthy food is the right of every American. Excellent ideas, but who can afford it? Well, Tracy McMillan is a reporter who took on this bear of a project. That is, to learn firsthand how those slogans play in the lives of a large percentage of us. What she unearthed is in her book, The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farmfields, and the Dinner Table. Tracy, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Tracy, you set out to see, is it possible to eat healthily and eat well when you're working as most low-income Americans work? And one of the places that you decided to actually go and work was Walmart. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, well, Walmart, you know, it's, for New Yorkers, it sort of seems like this exotic place because we don't have one yet. So to go and work at Walmart, I decided to go outside of Detroit because Detroit's known for being a city with very little in the way of fresh groceries. And I thought this would be really interesting, right, to sort of live in a place known as being a food desert and then be commuting out to a national grocer the same way a lot of people were doing for their grocery shopping. And I think the most interesting thing I sort of cottoned onto in my work at Walmart was just that there's this very strong narrative that we hear about corporate efficiencies and how, you know, everything works like this very cleanly, well-oiled machine. And at least in the Walmart I was at, that completely broke down when it came to produce. I spent a shift one day throwing out about 200 pounds of asparagus that had molded and rotted in the cooler and hadn't been rotated out. It was about 6 weeks old. The cooler had a leak from the ceiling that lasted almost the entire duration of my time there, so about a month. So we were losing a lot of produce in that way. And it just was this very interesting lesson in both how difficult and tricky it is to manage a produce section, right? Because if you think about it, you know, somebody has to be on top of, you know, the 300 to 500 items that are all dying at different rates in front of you, as well as just a really good lesson in, you know, that's really important. You know, we talk so much about wanting to love your farmer and know your farmer, but I came out of this feeling like, you know, we really should know and love our produce managers because that's a really difficult job and it's incredibly important for us.
But Walmart is one of the places that's touting that they're selling produce at prices that would be affordable to just about everybody.
Yeah, Walmart does a really good job of telling everyone how much lower their prices are, which tends to be true if you're comparing a grocery basket, sort of a typical basket of goods. Walmart's prices on produce are not necessarily any lower than local grocery stores. When I was in Detroit, I actually did a comparison between my little local grocery store, La Colmena, in southwest Detroit, and the Walmart at which I had been working. And the produce, on average, was 7% cheaper in Detroit as opposed to buying it at Walmart. And fresh meat, sort of the basket I had of that, was 17% cheaper in Detroit than at Walmart. And part of that's because Walmart doesn't have to compete the same way that we think of in economics, right? Walmart is such a huge store that they can just play with their pricing cocktail however much they want. And because they do so much private label development, right, so they're doing a lot of their own processed food in-house, that stuff is always going to be so much cheaper than the national brands that when you compare, you know, buying all of your groceries at Walmart, where Walmart saves you money is the processed stuff.
So you were really working undercover, and your goal was to live on what you made, just as everyone else that worked in this store and in other places did, and see how that worked out for you. But you began by actually working in the fields where our food is grown in the Salinas Valley, right, in California. Mm-hmm. And first of all, I'm just curious, how much do you make when you're working as a farm worker?
I typically was earning between $2 and $4 an hour. I was being paid straight piece rate. So when I was working in garlic, I got $1.60 for every 5-gallon bucket I could fill with cut heads of garlic. So
that's, you know, nothing. The employer,
it did not turn out to be very much money. My first day, I picked 10 buckets. So that's $16. And my wages were not brought up to minimum wage, which is illegal. Like, you're not even,
yeah, I thought
if you're
you had to get minimum wage.
You have to get minimum wage. So, you know, if I'm a bad picker, it is my employer's job to bring my wages up to minimum. That just wasn't happening, in large part because most of the folks I was working alongside were undocumented. And so they weren't very inclined to complain.
How do you live on that kind of money?
You know, there's no real big secret to it. They just sort of cut as many costs as they can. So, you know, when I was living in the Salinas Valley, I was sharing a small 2-bedroom house with about 16 or 17 other people. So in one bedroom, there was a family of 7. In the second bedroom, there was a family of 4. I had a little cubby that I paid for off the living room, and I was paying sort of top dollar in terms of farm worker rent. So I paid about $300 for 7 weeks of housing. And then there were between four and six single men living in the garage in a shed built off the back of it called the casita. And so we all shared one bathroom and one kitchen. And, you know, there were communal meals with the family of 7 they would share with me. And because my Spanish is poor, it was never totally clear to me if this was straight charity on their part or if they considered it included as part of room and board, because mm-hmm. there was sometimes food shared with the other folks in the house as well.
So, Tracy, for a year, you were working essentially undercover. Is there one picture that comes to your mind when you look back at that time?
I mean, I think the main picture that would come up for me is, you know, a kitchen with empty cupboards, maybe, because I really just didn't have enough money to buy the kinds of pantry staples, the kinds of condiments and all these fancy things that, you know, in my normal life, I forget what a luxury it is to have a well-stocked pantry. You know, it's very easy to cook quickly and well when you have, you know, a few different vinegars, a couple different oils, you know, a panoply of spices. You know, that makes it really easy to cook something delicious very quickly. It's really not as much fun to cook when you're sort of stuck with salt, pepper, oregano, rice, and beans.
Mm-hmm. Tracy, thanks for talking with us.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Journalist Tracy McMillan wrote The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. Well, after you hit the latest bargain sites for hotels and airfares, you'd better head to roadfood.com. This is where the good eats for little money ratio is high. Road Food's creators, Jane and Michael Stern, comb the country for finds and report back in. Jane, Michael, welcome back.
Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
So where have you been?
We've been in Orange County, California, which, as you probably know, is not necessarily a hotbed of great road food. There are all kinds of upscale restaurants, but when you're looking for kind of sleeves-up, inexpensive, casual fare, there isn't a whole lot of it.
You know, you can be pretty sure that the Real Housewives of Orange County are not out at diners road fooding.
Please, I'm sorry, don't get me started on that subject.
Okay. However, that's all a prologue to the fact that we did find a really wonderful place, inconspicuously located in a little shopping center in San Juan Capistrano. It's called El Campeón, which means the champion. And in fact, it is a champion of really terrific Mexican food, served very informally, in fact, dished out cafeteria style, and eaten even more informally, either at a counter stool or, as many people do, they just take it out onto the sidewalk and enjoy it in the open air.
So what kinds of things are they actually doing?
Well, very authentic Mexican foods, such as cabeza de res, beef head, birria, goat meat, carnitas, roasted pork, frijoles, cebolla, ensalada. I mean, you name it. It's the only authentic, really authentic Mexican restaurant that I've ever been to where unless you say C, they don't put cilantro on it until you give them the go-ahead, which I thought was kind of unusual. But as you well know, cilantro is a love it or hate it.
Yeah. In addition to the really great burritos and tortas and different kinds of sandwiches and plates of food, they also have some really great drinks. You know, a lot of these Mexican restaurants that we've found in southern Arizona and so forth do this as well. I mean, the list of aguas frescas include strawberry, tamarind, watermelon, horchata, which is the rice milk drink, mango. I mean, all these wonderful flavors, and many of them are kept in these big glass tureens. So it's like a rainbow of these beautiful fruit drinks.
Very festive, like the colors of the Mexican flag, to use a cliche.
They are so refreshing.
Yes.
And one of the things I've always wondered is why hasn't this spread beyond the Mexican restaurant?
That is a perfect question.
I think it's beginning now, but this idea of these fresh fruit drinks, and they're icy and they're gorgeous to look at, and they're so fresh and so light and so delicious.
And they're so appropriate when you're eating food that's kind of very spicy and zesty and, you know, full of these really intense flavors. I mean, those refreshing drinks are just a perfect companion.
So is this place, you know, like, is it a bustling cafeteria with lots of tables and everybody shuffling trays? Is it a...
No tables. I mean, there are counters with stools. I mean,
and it's a bakery, so you can see the baked goods that are displayed when
it's a bakery and also a little grocery store. I mean, it's a one-stop shopping area for anything. So if you want to cook food at home, if you happen to have a kitchen nearby, you can buy, you know, the groceries there too. But no, there are no tables. What you do is stand in line and you point to what you want or communicate, if you can speak well in Spanish, as to exactly what you want. And you get a tray, and you can either carry the tray to a counter and sit on a stool at the counter, or, as I said, many people will take these things right outside on the sidewalk and dine off the hood of their car.
I love it. I love it. Also, the idea that they're a bakery, the Mexican sweets.
Oh, absolutely.
God, they're good. Yeah.
It's a full service stop.
I like that. Guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jade and Michael Stern are the creators and minds behind roadfood.com. Now, check out their latest finds, too, at splendidtable.org. Now, I'd venture to say that until you've eaten Moroccan-style vegetables, you have not tasted what a veg can become. Okay, I'm prejudiced, because for me, everyone who loves to eat should know how Morocco cooks. A recent book by Jeff Kohler is a good start. It's Morocco, A Culinary Journey with Recipes. Jeff's roamed the country for a decade, especially the little-known regions, or at least little-known to us. The Berber village high in the Atlas Mountains, eating with families from communal platters. Jeff joins us from his home in Spain. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, you've traveled to parts of Morocco that we don't hear very much about. Can you give me some idea of the kinds of vegetable dishes you found and where you found them?
Well, Morocco is, I mean, really essentially kind of an island. You know, you have the Atlantic on one side, and you have the Mediterranean to the north, and you have this kind of sea of the Sahara around it. But in the middle, this incredible variety of, you know, four mountain ranges and oasis and desert and river valleys, and you really find a pretty big variety of vegetables. For me, my favorite place is probably south of Casablanca and along the coast called El Jadida. And this is really the heartland of different kinds of squash and pumpkins. And just kind of driving on the back road, you see they're able to mound them up. These really interesting stacks, you saw them on the roadside. They're really quite large types of squashes. And these you find absolutely as a salad. You find in couscous. I mean, pumpkin couscous is a great middle part of the country dish. You know, this is one of the most typical meals that you can find.
Yeah, when I think of a Moroccan meal, I think of it beginning with this incredibly colorful spread of salads.
Absolutely. One of the great things about, I think, dining in Morocco is the selection of fresh and cooked salads. You have a kind of a combination. Many of the cooked ones are served in the summertime, maybe chilled, and maybe in the winter, warm or room temperature. And you get everything from beets to, you know, different kinds of green peppers to cucumbers. And you get this spread. And often you prepare a couple of them, three or four or five or six, and you serve just small dishes. But you begin by just kind of nibbling. And when you see the spread laid out, it's always impressive because of the colors and the design element. I mean, I've been to meals where I've been served 10, 12, even one place, 15 different types of small little salads kind of to open the meal. But, of course, for me, that was the whole meal. I mean, this is my favorite part of a meal is the salads, along with some of that really great round flatbread.
So typically, what kind of spicing is done with salads in Morocco?
Well, first you find a lot of fresh herbs. It seems like almost everything has fresh cilantro and fresh parsley. And these are usually mixed together, finely chopped up. And it's almost rare that you're going to find one or the other. They're often together. For spices, cinnamon is very typical. Interesting mixture with the savory flavors. Cumin. Sweet paprika, usually not spicy. In some dishes will have a spicier paprika, but often a little bit of sweet paprika, freshly ground black pepper. Right. Other things have much more in a very specific reason, but those are the main ones.
I'm remembering something specific that I've had in a restaurant. It was carrots done with orange.
Yeah, one of the great salads with carrots is very finely grated carrots with fresh squeezed orange juice. And this should be soup enough for you. You just need a spoon to eat it. And again, you chill it, and then you sprinkle it with cinnamon and maybe a couple of drops of orange flower water. Fantastic combination of this freshness with the fruitiness, and then you get the cinnamon. And it's often kind of hard to pinpoint what exactly is in it. And then you could have on the same spread another great carrot salad, and you boil the carrots usually, and then they're a little bit sweet, pinch of sugar, and then you put plenty of cumin in them. And a little pinch of maybe sweet paprika, a little bit of lemon juice, and you chill them. And that is one of those dishes that you get this interesting combination of the real earthiness of the cumin, and you get that lemon, and you get the sweetness of the chilled carrots. And again, when you have, you know, four or five or six or eight of these different little salads, it's a real, you don't quite know where to begin or where to stop. I mean, and in the summertime, you know, the carrot and the orange one is equally served as a salad and also as a dessert. Because it's a fantastic way to end the meal. And then with that touch of cinnamon, it's really interesting and original and refreshing and absolutely perfect.
Sounds like if we just do the salads from Morocco, we're going to be home free. Jeff, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Jeff Kohler is author of Morocco, A Culinary Journey with Recipes. Get Jeff's recipes for those simple carrot dishes, grated carrot and orange salad, and carrot and cumin salad. Go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, the trivia challenge of the week is ready, and it's a new finding. What surprising food discovery was made recently in the Sahara Desert? Well, we're going to be back with the answer and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Or actually call us, 800-537-5252. But before we connect, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what surprising food discovery was made recently in the Sahara Desert? Well, first, it's been discovered that there were dairy farmers in the Sahara 7,000 years ago. Now, this was when the Sahara was lush and green. Up until now, it was thought Saharan people were still in the hunting and gathering stage then. Second, they were processing their milk, heating it in pottery containers, and possibly making yogurt and cheese and butter. Now, that was advanced technology 7,000 years ago. Curiously, most people were lactose intolerant then, but these dairy people figured out that processing milk made it easier to digest. And the proof is in the pottery shards found on the site with traces of dairy fat. Rock paintings in Libya show how longhorn cattle were being milked. I mean, this stuff is remarkable. The journal Nature reported all of it in June 2012. And an intriguing aside in the article is that the human tolerance for lactose came later from genes that evolved in us. So what drove those particular genes to evolve? And why are some parts of the world still lactose intolerant and some not?
I love you.
It is time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Like us on Facebook, check us out on Twitter, or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. We've got Clark calling from St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Clark, what's up? What is on your mind?
Hi there, Lynn. I have a nitrogen-powered whipped cream maker.
Right.
And I want to know, what else can I use that for? I've tried a few things. I tried, you know, mixing in Jell-O with the whipped cream to make strawberry-flavored whipped cream or chocolate and so on. And I tried putting eggs in there once, but that just kind of flopped. So I wonder, is there anything else I can do?
Essentially, you're doing a foam, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anything that you can puree, I mean, chefs have done things like taken potatoes and mashed them, put them through a sieve so there's absolutely no lumps, and then you can add a bit of moisture to that, some milk, some cream or whatever, and you put it through that little gizmo and you've got foam potatoes. I've actually had anchovies done that way. But it it was an anchovy paste with lemon juice. And I must say, it was pretty cool. I mean, if you like anchovies and lemon juice, it was pretty swell. So anything that you can have in a liquid form or in a thinned out form, you know, about the texture of the cream, you can use in that machine or in that gadget. Sweet potatoes, turnips, beets. Beet foam is gorgeous. And again, you can flavor these things too. So, you know, you could take any vegetable, puree it, add a little bit of moisture to it, and then put it through, and you could have something fabulous. And the same is true with fruit. Just make sure there's no fiber in it. Put it through a sieve. Or a food mill. Yeah, and then give that a shot.
Great, thank you.
Oh, and wait a minute. There's a website to check out. PolySci or PolyScience. They sell all of this equipment, but they also have recipes and techniques and all kinds of information.
I will check that out. I see that right now.
take a look. You may end up with a kitchen full of more equipment. Wait until you get the machine. It's only $10,000.
But perfect.
But there's this, I think it's actually called something like the Gastronominator. I'm making that up, but it's similar. You can infuse things. So this is a machine where, let's say, you put coconut water and asparagus in it, and you turn it on, and when you open the chamber, the asparagus is crisp and green, is beautiful. But when you taste it, it tastes like coconut water.
Ooh.
You just need a spare 10,000, but it's really fabulous.
I'll see what I can do. Maybe I'll send them a tweet or something and send me one to blog about.
Yeah, exactly. A little test model for you. Hey, have fun. This is going to be great fun for you. Take care.
Thanks a lot.
Bye. We've got Cindy on the line from Findlay, Ohio. Cindy, what can I do for you?
Hi, Lynn. I was wondering if you could give me a couple ideas for something Greek. Here's the situation. My wonderful daughter this past school year has been taking some online classes in Greek and Roman history. And the instructors of these classes plan a trip every year to either Greece, Turkey, or Italy, depending on the year. And this is the year for Greece.
Oh, brother.
Yeah,
what a,
I know.
Whoa.
Well, when my daughter found out about this trip, she got a job at the local coffee shop, and she started saving every penny, and she wanted to finance this trip, which she did. She is there.
That's fabulous.
I know. Well, I am picking her up tomorrow, and as you can imagine, after having a total blast, she is not ready to come home. So what I would like to do is welcome her back with a Greek meal, kind of ease her back into the real world again.
That's a wonderful, wonderful idea.
Well, my extent of Greek cuisine is pretty much a Greek salad and baklava, so I need some help.
Well, you know, one of the things you can do is do lamb kebabs.
Okay.
Marinate the lamb with olive oil and fresh lemon and a little grated lemon rind and oregano and garlic. And choose tender lamb, so something cut from the leg.
Okay.
And you want to cut it in maybe one-inch chunks.
All right.
And you can then marinate it overnight in that mixture. Be generous with the olive oil. Okay.
Okay.
Then you can put it. Do you like to grill?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Slow grill on this. You want it pink inside, but you want to do a really slow grill. You don't want to do, you know, high fire.
Okay.
And then with that, what you could do is you cook long grain rice. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways I do this is to, it's really the, what I call, you know, the dummy's rice, because I'm a dummy about rice.
Mm-hmm.
I cook it like pasta, drop it in a big pot of boiling salted water. And you cook it maybe 10, 15 minutes. You taste it, obviously,
okay.
Right?
All
you,
right?
You drain it and you toss that with lots of fresh dill, okay?
Okay.
A bit of olive oil, fresh lemon juice, and again, you're echoing these flavors, but I would throw in also, this is when it's all cooled down,
mm-hmm.
obviously, a bit of garlic and onion that you've allowed to mellow in the lemon juice before you add it, because otherwise it's raw onion, it'll just kill you.
Okay.
And sweet cherry tomatoes that you cut in half. Okay,
okay,
so that's what your kebab is going to rest on, that salad, which is really beautiful to look at.
Okay.
Oh, I forgot. You want mint in there, too.
All right.
Lots of fresh mint. And then you're going to have roasted peppers on the grill as
mm-hmm.
well. And you're going to roast those peppers. And if you can get the long, narrow peppers, they're not hot.
Mm-hmm.
But they're, you know what I mean?
Yep.
They're thin-skinned, and they tend to not have that strong bell pepper taste.
Right.
Roasted peppers just with coarse salt.
Okay.
I think you're going to have a great meal.
Oh,
very, very, very simple.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And also, is she at an age where she's drinking wine?
Well, she better not be.
All right. Forget that. Okay. Some good fresh lemonade is going to be fabulous. Yeah. With maybe a drop of orange flower water,
right,
if you can get it. But I think that's really a simple, simple meal.
Okay.
Hey, thanks, Cindy.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us 800-537-5252. You know, when folks try to sell us on the five-a-day mantra, they say, look at vegetables with new eyes. See their endless possibilities. Well, Rebecca Rupp did just that. She's a science and nature writer, and her new look at the vegetable aisle produced not recipes, but stories, the intriguing, the wacky, and the mythical sides of five-a-day. Her book is How Carrots Won the Trojan War, Curious but True Stories of Common Vegetables, and Rebecca joins us from Vermont. Rebecca, good to have you with us.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here.
So, how did carrots win the Trojan War?
Oh, carrots are one of those sort of horseshoe nail stories, you know, little things that had big effects.
Right, right.
The story goes that when the Greeks were penned up inside the Trojan horse, they ate carrots to bind their bowels, is the quote, presumably eliminating the need for bathroom breaks, which allowed them to lie low long enough to be dragged into the city, ambush the populace, and win the war.
I see. Okay.
Which is sort of interesting, considering that the Greeks' alternative use for carrots was that they were aphrodisiacs. And supposedly the Greek soldiers plied their female captives with carrots to break down their inhibitions.
Oh, so
it seems an odd mix.
It really does, yes. And I don't really want to know about what went on in that Trojan horse while they were waiting to attack.
Well, you know, practically anything even remotely cylindrical in the garden was an aphrodisiac.
Right.
Except cucumbers.
Why not cucumbers?
Apparently their reputation was cooling. So cucumbers and lettuce were supposed to damp down sexual ardor.
I see. Is there any truth to the business about carrots help night vision?
Actually, there is. Carrots are a great source of vitamin A, which is a precursor of a visual pigment called rhodopsin.
Ah.
So one of the first signs of a lack of vitamin A is you tend to lose night vision.
You say something about the pilots in World War II ate carrots? They were told to eat carrots?
They didn't exactly, but I love the story. The British Air Force had acquired radar at one point in World War II, but they didn't want the Germans to know. So there was one particularly superb pilot whose nickname was Cat's Eye Cunningham. And Cat's Eye was known for his expertise in shooting down German planes using the new radar technique, hoping to distract the Germans from all the radar towers that were now bristling along the British coast. They put out this rumor that Cunningham and his fellow pilots were being fed this prodigious diet of carrots, which allowed them to see in the dark. It's not clear this fooled the Germans, but it was really picked up by the British public, who started eating a lot of carrots in hopes that it would help them navigate in the blackout.
Oh, well, switching gears to some other things we see all the time in the vegetable aisle. How about lettuce, and why is money often referred to as lettuce?
Oh, lettuce. Money became green, actually, during the Civil War under Abraham Lincoln, who printed the first green banknotes, and the Union Army was paid with them, and they called them greenbacks. And they stayed, of course, in circulation forever. And eventually, money picked up a whole bunch of green-related names. Around the turn of the century, it was called kale. In the 1920s, green money was called lettuce. In the 1940s, it was called cabbage.
Huh.
I love this. And then the Confederate money, which was either gray or blue, was called shucks, from corn shucks.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
Or corn husks, because it was essentially worthless.
Ah, and speaking of corn, there's something in the book, corn creates vampires?
Well, there's a theory. Corn isn't a complete protein source. It lacks a couple of essential amino acids. And it doesn't have much of anything in the way of niacin, which is vitamin B3.
Right.
So a diet that's really, really heavy in corn can lead to a vitamin deficiency disease called pellagra, which was a real problem in the American South in the late 1800s and beginning of the 20th century. Pellagra came to Europe kind of neck and neck with when people started eating American corn. And the disease was... The sufferers from pellagra were first called the butterfly people because they got this butterfly-shaped rash on their face. But as the disease progressed, the symptoms included sun sensitivity, dementia, and kind of a slow, wasting death. It was really an awful disease.
Yeah.
So all these thin, pale, peculiar, light-avoiding people, a couple of researchers in the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine in Britain postulated, were the source of vampire legends. They sounded a lot like vampires. So one theory is that maybe Dracula just needed a dose of vitamin B3.
And he would have been fine.
He might have been fine.
And lay off the corn on the cob.
No kidding. South Carolina at one point even put corn on trial on a charge of murder.
Really? When was that?
I think around right at the beginning of the 20th century, around 1905 or so.
Huh.
They didn't know how to treat pellagra or what it was.
Right, right.
And, you know, obviously, you had to blame someone.
If only people ate the beans with the corn.
Right.
Everything would have been fine. Hey, Rebecca, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Rupp is the author of How Carrots Won the Trojan War, Curious but True Stories of Common Vegetables. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us, and until next time, let me leave you with this warning from a local health food store. Shoplifters will be beaten over the head with an organic carrot. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. You can get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcast, make a visit to our online store, and don't miss our newest publication. It's an ebook quarterly called Eating In With Lynn, Volume 2, The Big Summer Party. You can find it all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Ruffle with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. You have a good one. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.